Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Saturday morning Dhamma class from Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey on December 8, 2018. My Dhamma talk and our Sangha discussion is the first of two talks on the Dhatuvibhanga Sutta. This sutta shows the Buddha's view on the complete and impersonal ordinariness of human life. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace. Today's sutta, and at least for the next two classes, maybe three, we'll see how it goes, is on the Dhatuvibhanga Sutta. The subtitle is The Buddha's Analysis of the Properties, meaning the properties that constitute a person. And as you'll see in this sutta, these properties that the Buddha describes are completely ordinary. There's nothing personal. And each and every one of them is impermanent. And the point of this sutta gets right to the heart of what the Buddha is teaching, that it is through self-identification and personalizing what is inherently impersonal, we create confusion, deluded thinking, and ongoing stress and suffering for ourselves and others. I want to lay some foundation for this, though. I always say, not always, but almost always, that everything the Buddha taught was taught in the context of dependent origination and Four Noble Truths. And that very first teaching he gave was the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, establishing the Four Noble Truths as the foundation for everything that he would teach from his entire teaching career. I was asked an interesting question a few weeks ago. I think it was on a Tuesday. Yeah, it was Tuesday class. And I didn't quite take the inference, but the gentleman asked, do you think the Buddha was the only enlightened human being? And my quick answer was yes, but the qualification is that it really depends on how you define that. And we've certainly had very advanced, and in some ways you could call these people enlightened. The Roman and Greek philosophers all come to mind. Modern day people like Nelson Mandela and Martin Luther King, in their own way, were certainly enlightened beings. Gandhi comes to mind. A little bit of an obscure reference would be Jiddu Krishnamurti. I think he was a very advanced, had a very advanced understanding of human beings and the human condition. Yet the defining characteristic between all of those people I just mentioned and the Buddha was that Siddhartha Gautama, the Buddha, taught an eightfold path. He taught a direct path that any and every human being that engaged in that path could awaken as he did, and in that definition of what he describes as awakening. Excuse me. And the Buddha's description of an awakened human being is having developed profound right view that understands at that profound and penetrating level the Four Noble Truths, beginning with a profound and penetrating understanding of suffering, a profound and penetrating understanding and abandoning of the origination of suffering, craving for and clinging to views rooted in ignorance of those Four Noble Truths. The fourth noble truth, from the point of view of an awakened human being, is the truth of having the experience of the cessation of suffering, of abandoning all views rooted in ignorance. And the fourth noble truth, from the point of view of right view, is having achieved that awakened state directly through the Eightfold Path. That's the Four Noble Truths. Upon the Buddha's awakening, and that reflects directly to what the Buddha awakened to. The Buddha awakened to one of the most misunderstood and misapplied teachings in all of Buddhism, called dependent origination. It's often characterized as interdependent co-arising or interbeing co-arising, or the implication is that everything is interconnected and we're all part of one grand cosmic being. It's a wonderful thought. Other people have stated the same thing. Many modern teachers teach that. It's simply not what this enlightened human being taught, because from this enlightened human being's thinking, that type of craving for and clinging to constant connection to everything else is the root cause of becoming further ignorant, and I'll explain that just further on. So the Buddha awakened to dependent origination, which very clearly states, from ignorance of Four Noble Truths comes fabrications. Fabrications are simply a perverted way of looking at, not in the classic sense of perversion. Perverted simply meaning we have we have, we're seeing the way, we're seeing ourselves in relation to the world in a way that is not rooted in truth, it's rooted in ignorance. It's a fabrication. From fabrications comes consciousness. Look at the progression here. From a mind rooted in ignorance comes a fabricated way of looking at yourself in relation to the world and everyone else in it. That feeds consciousness, but it's not, again, it's not a grand kind of consciousness. It's ongoing thinking rooted in what? Rooted in ignorance. And also, this dependent origination is not a creation myth. It doesn't describe how people get born into the world, which is what many modern Buddhists claim that that's what it is, but that's from another book that the Buddha didn't teach called the Abhidhamma. It creates a very mystical explanation of dependent origination. Dependent origination simply clarifies 12 steps that leads to suffering. And these steps, you can say, happen outside of time, meaning that it's not, the progression isn't something that we can slow it down quick enough to see each and every one of them, but we know just by simply listening to this that this is what occurs. Ignorance leads to fabrication, leads to consciousness, ongoing thinking rooted in ignorance. That type of consciousness leads to something called nama-rupa or name and form. Nama-rupa is the Pali word for name and form. Again, a very misunderstood teaching. Name and form simply means self-identification, identifying with form, but self-identification with things that are inherently impersonal and all are impermanent, yet we personalize them and try to create a permanence about them from a fabricated point of view, rooted in ignorance. You following the progression?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
From name and form, as a requisite condition, comes the sixth sense base, our five senses, interpreted by that third link, consciousness, but consciousness rooted in ignorance. So again, follow the progression here. From a mind rooted in ignorance, a human being self-identifying with form is using their senses to continue fabrication. How else can you do it if your mind is fabricating things? What's coming into through contact, in an ordinary way, you are personalizing it. Consciousness leads to name and form leads to the sixth sense base. Got me?
Mm-hmm.
From the sixth sense base, what happens when something comes through contact? A feeling. And a feeling in this sense is any disturbance in the mind. In the Buddha, in other suttas, in fact this one when I get to it, goes through the progression of each one of our sense organs also has an aspect of consciousness about it, eye consciousness, ear consciousness, etc. From feeling comes contact. Makes sense, doesn't it? And again, this is not some mystical teaching at all. It's simply describing the progression that from a mind rooted in ignorance ends up confused, deluded, and prone to suffering. From feeling comes contact. Makes sense. From that contact comes clinging and maintain. From feeling comes craving. Wrong.
No, that's right.
From contact comes feeling. From feeling comes craving. So something comes into through my senses and I experience it and I like it. And I self-identify with it, I want more of it, craving. The other side of craving is aversion. It's the other side of the same coin. Aversion is simply craving for something to be non-existent in our life or to have less of it. From craving comes clinging and maintaining. Once I've self-identified with something that I feel that I need to be happy or I need to avoid to maintain my happiness and security, I am now clinging to that. I've created a view, a condition, aspect of my mind. And once that's established, the rest of my life, I'm basically maintaining what I think I need to be happy in my mind. I'm always grasping after it. Is that clear?
Yeah. Yeah.
And so you can see, and really even in this explanation, you can almost feel the stress inherent in this type of views and living in this way. But this is what we all do, as an awakened human being described. From clinging and maintaining comes becoming. Now remember the context. There's never a modifier there, which also leads to all kinds of speculation because it's not seen in context. From clinging and maintaining as a requisite condition comes becoming what? The context says becoming further ignorant, unless something occurs to interrupt that ignorance and shine the light on that. Excuse me. And it points to the incredible potential of the Eightfold Path that brings us into the moment. When we can develop concentration through a right meditation practice and start framing our thinking through the Eightfold Path, then each and every moment holds the potential to become awakened, as opposed to the potential in a mind rooted in ignorance to become only further ignorant. From clinging and maintaining comes becoming. The choice is ours whether we're going to extricate ourselves from this process. From becoming, as a requisite condition, comes birth. Now again, this isn't a creation myth, and it's not even a physical birth myth, except only in the most insignificant context. And I won't even bother to talk about that. Again, remember, this is something that is happening really outside of time. We can't pick up the progression unless we have a quiet mind and understand what we're looking for. From a mind rooted in ignorance, through this process, the only thing we can do is give birth to another moment rooted in ignorance. That's the significant aspect of giving birth. It's not physical birth, it's what we are giving birth to, what we are causing to arise in our own experience. Is that clear?
Yeah.
From birth as a requisite condition comes all manner of suffering. I don't want to get into the whole explanation, but all manner of suffering follows from that. So from ignorance, through this 12 links of dependent origination, comes confusion, deluded thinking, and ongoing suffering. And so the Buddha taught those four noble truths that I mentioned just earlier as a way of recognizing and abandoning ignorance that is only going to lead to more suffering. And the reason why I'm doing this in this context is to point out that suffering rooted in ignorance is completely impersonal when it's seen correctly. Do you see that?
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing personal about it except what we make personal in that process. And I just want to mention one other sutta before I get to today's sutta, put it into context. And this is from the Loka Sutta. And this all has to do with what we are going to become in this human life. It's the reason why I called that that last book, Becoming Buddha, Becoming Awakened, because that's the choice we have. The Buddha says in the Loka Sutta, the life integrated with the Eightfold Path is lived for the abandoning of becoming. Do you see how it relates directly to dependent origination? For the abandoning of becoming further ignorant. Those that say that escape from becoming is by non-becoming are never released from becoming, I declare. And that's really the line that I want to explain what that means. They're never released from non-becoming means we create ideological views of ourselves about what we need and who we are in the world. And so we create something that is other than self, don't we? It's really just our imagination, even if it plays out in reality. In other words, I'm the world's greatest baker, you know, because somebody's, or, you know, or more mundane might be a friend of yours says, you know, if you eat mushrooms, you're really going to be healthy. And so you start eating mushrooms and you feel better. And now you're the mushroom king when it's just mushrooms and you happen to feel better. Do you see the imaginary establishment in non-becoming? So now I'm the mushroom king. Or the baker king, or the golfer king, or, you know, pick one, you know. It doesn't matter. We do this with insignificant things, such as our daily activities, and it might be what we do for a living, or our position in the world. We create an ideological and an imaginary establishment of that, and then we live in it, and we try to defend it. That's what the Buddha means about non-becoming. And also the mystical aspects and applications of modern Buddhism, such as aspiring to nothingness or an environment of emptiness. The Buddha never taught that. Or trying to establish the dimension of the infinitude of space or infinitude of consciousness or neither perception or non-perception. We've talked about that. That's all trying to, it all arises from a misunderstanding of a self and attempting to become anything other than self. And do you understand that last line? So I create things in my mind because who I am, for one thing, I don't understand it, so I can't establish it, and it's inadequate. It's there's not enough. So I create something in my mind to aspire to supplant that thing that I'm not enough of. Do you see that clearly?
Yeah.
And one of these days, what if I can ever finish it, the underlying stress in that, I'm getting a little bit off, well, not really, when I get to the other sutta, there's an aspect of self-loathing in there, isn't there? What really comes down to, I'm simply not enough, so I have to become something more. That's non-becoming. And any time we try to do that, whether it's within Buddhist practice, which is very, very common, or we don't have any Buddhist practice at all, but we're stuck in that aspect of always establishing ourselves in a way that is non-becoming. Because it's non-becoming, it can never satisfy, and it can only cause stress. So let me just finish that little bit from the Loka Sutta, and then I'll get to today's sutta, maybe. The Buddha continues, stress arises in dependence on becoming self, meaning this idealized view of self. With the ending of clinging to self and maintaining self, no stress will arise. It relates directly to dependent origination. Look at the world. Human beings afflicted with ignorance crave for and cling to becoming, my words, anything other than self. All forms of becoming, anywhere in any way, are impermanent, stressful, and always subject to change. Knowing this, the arising and the passing away from right view, craving for becoming and non-becoming is abandoned. Is there any questions about that? Is it clear what I'm referring to in relation to dependent origination? And as a foundation for Dhamma practice, to recognize and abandon self-identification, self-referential views that are leading us to become something that we can possibly be, which is a personalized, permanent human experience, rather than to develop the concentration and right mindfulness that leads to this profound and gentle suppleness of mind where we're simply present with our life as life occurs. Okay.
So, yeah, I have a question.
Please.
I always struggle with the non-becoming. So, is non-becoming like craving for just becoming something that's still becoming, isn't it?
It's endless. It's insatiable.
Non-becoming is just becoming something that you're not, which is still becoming.
Yes.
Right?
Okay. Yeah, because, and look at it, it's rooted in ignorance.
It's just kind of hitting all of the ways of thinking about it is why he's saying non-becoming.
Yeah, and it's so important. Thank you for bringing it up. And you know, again, we might not even get to the sutta today, but this is this is so important because it lies at the heart of what the Buddha awakened to. Remember the Aryaparyasana Sutta, on his noble search for awakening, and he studied with these two great teachers. They were teaching to establish yourself. One was in the dimension of infinite consciousness, and the other was the infinite, the dimension of neither perception nor non-perception. And they were revered spiritual teachers. They were this is the highest type of spiritual teaching you could engage in. The Buddha understood it very quickly and realized that's simply an establishment in an imaginary, non-physical realm that is an aspect of non-becoming. This is what led him to teach things this way. From his own experience of realizing what it wasn't, now he understands what it is.
It's almost as if everyone else is teaching the extraordinary and the Buddha is simply teaching the ordinary.
Yes, and why would you teach anything to elevate yourself to extraordinary from self-referential, self-identification views rooted in the compulsion to continue to elevate myself to something other than what I'm not. I'm not good enough. Let me create a doctrine that will do that, including something as the inherent fear of death that we all have. So let me create a doctrine, even within Buddhism, of a way to establish myself in a non-physical realm. The foremost and predominant form of modern Buddhism does just that. In fact, it's taught, and I'll simplify just a little bit. If you develop this chant, I used to know it, and keep it on your lips continually, but most importantly, at when you die, this is, I won't say it. Well, the form of Buddhism is called Pure Land Buddhism, and there's many variants of it, but this is the predominant form of Buddhism. If you have this chant on your lips when you die, you'll be instantly taken to, it's called Tulsita Buddhist Heaven, and there you'll be taken care of forever and ever by Abhidhamma Buddha. He'll take care of all your needs.
So simply there, you're taking the most ordinary thing,
a human life, just like the Buddha
pass, yes. And they're making it something that is relieving yourself of that stress of that ordinariness.
Yep. And once I buy into it, okay, yeah, it's a trick. And now my mind is diluted towards that. And I might gain a measure of peace about that, won't I? But most people don't anyway. Most people that believe in life after death, that really doesn't bring them comfort. Although I don't want to get into that too deeply. All of that, whether it's done in those extreme cases to establish myself in extraordinary non-physical realms, or just as I'm the world's best baker and I got to keep it up, those all cause stress, and it's all rooted in self-identification. So, and that self-identification, when we understand dependent origination, originates in ignorance. Is that clear?
That's clear, but I'm still stuck on non-becoming and becoming. Is non-becoming is just another way of becoming?
Or is yes, it, and it's rooted in the same, it's still rooted in ignorance. So all that.
So what's the difference? Is there a difference?
It's all part of this confused mind. What the Buddha's teaching, the best way to look at non-becoming is attempting to establish yourself in your imagination or in a non-physical realm. And anything that is an idealized view of myself is an imagination, even though it might play out in reality. It's really only occurring in my mind. I'm just using an example of the world's greatest. Because I'm a baker, I got to be the world's greatest baker, or I hope that people recognize me. I hope people think that my chocolate cake is better than. And again, this might not be your confusion, but I'm just using it as an example.
Perfect.
Yeah, and we do this with everything that we do. And again, it's not right or wrong. It's complete. The problem with it, no matter whatever imaginary existence we establish ourselves in, again, even if it's playing out in our physical life, is going to be disappointing and unsatisfactory, because it's never enough. Even if I get recognized as the world's greatest baker, I might hear about, Emerald, comes along and eat, well, he's not a baker, but it's never enough. I always, and even if it's true, even if we can get a consensus of the 900 billion people in the world, and they all say John Haspel is the world's greatest baker, we know it, I'm disappointed. Because the next moment comes along and I have to continually establish myself in that way. And what does it matter? It doesn't elevate my thinking. I can't go from insisting that I'm the world's greatest baker to being awakened, because I'm stuck to that view. It's a distracting view. Do you see that?
So, mm-hmm. So the practice is there to interrupt that cycle,
right,
and to establish mindfulness and concentration so you can see it and then abandon it.
Yes. Yeah, so craving for becoming or non-becoming is simply rooted in that ignorance. My mind is rooted in ignorance, and I'm going to become a self. And another part of the sutta, the Buddha talks about becoming anything other than self, and that's what he means about non-becoming. In any non-physical realm, an imaginary realm, that's non-becoming. Okay, let me get to the... It's about time I get to the sutta. So this sutta shows the Buddha's view on the complete and impersonal ordinariness of human life. The objects of life that are constantly personalized through self-identification are shown to be common, fleeting, and having no substance worth self-identification. Excuse me. This sutta should be seen as a broad and far-reaching analysis of five clinging aggregates and how ignorance of Four Noble Truths creates fabricated views and an ongoing personalized experience of stress and suffering. Again, the reason why I reviewed dependent origination is so you'll see this in that light, what the Buddha awakened to. In this sutta, the Buddha describes the six properties that constitute a person. Notice that there is no reference to a soul or ground of being or inner Buddha nature or Buddhahood. Those last two are what most of Mahayana and even Theravada and Buddhism infers or directly teaches, that once we get rid of all these things, once we calm our minds down enough, this inner Buddha nature will simply spring out, or will be in Buddhahood, or will it's funny, but I followed that thinking for many, many years, and the reason why I'm bringing it up here is this: the Buddha gives a complete analysis of the six properties that make up a person, and nowhere does he say, oh yeah, and there's this other property or their, and no, and it, and it's not just in this sutta. There's no reference to a soul or a spirit or a Buddha nature or Buddhahood or anything inherent worth identifying with. And that would, and if you think about that, if the Buddha says, well, there's six properties to ignore, but there's a soul and you should identify with that soul. What is that? Self-identification to something impermanent. Okay. Or inner Buddha nature or Buddhahood. All of these common in modern Buddhism. As shown in this sutta and many others, those are all aspects of fabricated self-identification, craving for self-establishment in imaginary and speculative non-physical realms. We won't get to it today, but the end of we'll get to it next Saturday. The end of the sutta, the Buddha talks directly to the person he's talking to, called Pukkasati. He talks directly to Pukkasati about this establishing yourself in speculative or assumptive realms, non-physical realms, and recognize those are fabricated. We'll get to that next week, but we're going to get to the first part this week. I'm going to skip over some of my introduction to this and get to the sutta. The backstory is really interesting too. The Buddha was wandering among the Magadhans. He entered Rajagaha and went to the porter Bhagava. He asked Bhagava, "If it is no inconvenience for you, friend, I will stay for one night in your shed." "It is no inconvenience for me, but the wanderer Pukkasati has already taken up residence there. If he gives his permission, you may stay there as you like." Pukkasati, a fellow Sakyan, the Siddhartha Gautama was a Sakyan, that's the clan that he was a part of in northern India. Pukkasati was a fellow Sakyan, and he had gone forth into homelessness and was developing the Buddha's Dhamma. The Buddha approached Pukkasati and asked him if he could stay one night in his shed. Pukkasati replied, "This shed is roomy, my friend, stay as you like." The Buddha entered the shed and sat on a pile of leaves and grass. Folding his legs crosswise and holding his body erect, he set mindfulness to the fore and began jhana. He began to meditate. Pukkasati joined him in meditation for most of the evening. As morning approached, the Buddha had the thought, "How inspiring Pukkasati behaves. Let me question him on his understanding." He didn't tell him who he was yet, though. You can see the Buddha was there's many suttas where there's kind of a acute irreverence to what he's not taking himself so seriously. He doesn't come in and say, "Don't you know who I am?" He's playing a little game with Pukkasati and also to teach him something. "Venerable Pukkasati, out of dedication to whom have you gone forth? Who is your teacher and whose Dhamma are you practicing?" "Well, my teacher is Gautama, the contemplative, a Sakyan son. He is known far and wide as a Buddha, a rightly self-awakened one, who is consummate in clear knowing and of pure conduct. He is an expert of worldly affairs and the unsurpassed teacher of those fit to be taught." That's an important line. "I have gone forth with dedication to him as my teacher, and it is his Dhamma that I am practicing." "Well, friend Pukkasati, where is the Buddha staying now?" "Wanderer, I have heard that the Buddha is in Savatthi." Savatthi was in that, was probably, I remember my geography, probably about 60 or 70 miles from Rajagaha, all part of that area that Buddha taught in. "Have you met the Buddha, and would you recognize him?" "No, I have never met the Buddha, and I would not recognize him." The Buddha understood Pukkasati's devotion. Without identifying himself, he said to Pukkasati, "I will teach you the Dhamma, friend. Listen and pay close attention as I speak. A person has six properties, six media of sensory contact, leading to 18 distinct considerations." Now remember, he knows that Pukkasati already has a pretty thorough understanding and foundation in his teachings, and he knows dependent origination, Four Noble Truths, and the Eightfold Path. He's practicing that. "Furthermore, a well-focused Dhamma practitioner establishes four wise determinations based on understanding these properties. Having established these four wise determinations, this one has stilled the distraction of fabricated speculation and supposition. When the distraction of fabricated speculation and supposition has stilled, This one is said to be a sage of peace. He's clearly defining the end game of the Dhamma practice, the culmination of this Eightfold Path. A well-focused Dhamma practitioner should not neglect wise discernment. They should always guard the truth, meaning the Four Noble Truths. They should always be devoted to unbinding, meaning unbinding from views rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths, and train their minds only for calm. What an important point. Remember all the series we went to on jhana. The purpose of the Buddha's meditation practice is not to analyze anything, not to contemplate anything. It's to develop a mind deeply concentrated. And another aspect of a mind deeply concentrated is a mind that's calm. Once a mind has developed a measure of concentration, it can then incorporate the refined mindfulness to hold in mind the entire Eightfold Path. The Buddha's description of the quality of an awakened human being's mind is just that, calm. Nothing mystical, magical, ambiguous about that, simply calm. And for some people, that would seem like that's not even, well, why would I even bother? But when you think about that, that is the ultimate place of satisfaction, isn't it? Because there's nothing that can take it away. My mind, no matter what's occurring. That's the essence also of awakened mindfulness. It means that you're able to be mindful, present with what's occurring, no matter what it is. And it doesn't affect that quality of your mind. Calm. The Buddha says here, this is my summary and analysis of these six properties that make up every person. The earth property, the liquid property, the fire property, the wind property. We all know that's the four elements. The space property, and the consciousness property. Think about yourself. In relation to those six properties, that's all you are. Right? Does everybody agree with that? You're nothing else. You're not more than that. And as the Buddha teaches Pukkasati, nobody said yes, but as the Buddha teaches Pukkasati, these are simply ordinary aspects of an impermanent physical world. There's nothing personal about any of this. We can look in the mirror and see that we look differently from each other, but even in that, it's completely ordinary because everybody else looks different from everybody else too. There's nothing special that I look different than you. And imagine the profundity of even that understanding and what the difference that would make in this world if we could really understand it. I'm not going to go too deep into it. The Buddha concludes that by saying, a person has these six properties. Furthermore, a person has six media of sensory contact, the eye, the ear, the nose, the tongue, the body, and the intellect, the sixth sense base. A person has these six media. This is nice, this place. I have a backrest. A person has these six media of sensory contact.
You had a wall at the other place.
Yeah, but I was further away from it. I think I was just
right into it. Yeah, you had more room to move out.
Furthermore, a person has 18 considerations. Now, this is really getting to the heart of the Dhamma. Notice how these considerations, two of them, lead to continued distraction and continuing ignorance. One of them leads to awakening. On seeing form with the eye, one considers form as a basis for pleasure, or form as a basis for disappointment, or form as a basis for equanimity or calm. Everything that comes into our senses, I'll go through one more, is a basis for either distraction towards pleasure or pain, disappointment, or to see what's arising clearly in an impersonal way, and then it's a basis for continued equanimity. In other words, as something comes through my senses, I don't make it me or mine. I don't need it. I don't crave after. I don't cling to it. It's simply what's occurring. It's what's arising in my life. With no personalization, with no needing to use the object of what my sense contacts, my sense organs are coming in contact with, if I see it clearly, there's no craving, clinging, or maintaining, or becoming further ignorant. It's simply what's occurring. And in that way, I see this often, and I went through it myself. In that way, when we first start coming to understand the implications of this, it sounds like life would be incredibly bland and boring if I don't make things mine. But the paradox is then everything is part of your experience without it leading to agitation. No matter what it is. Think about that. That's the calm that the Buddha's talking about. We don't need to own things through ignorant self-identification or self-reference in order to live fully in the world. In fact, when we do, we have distracted ourselves from being fully mindfully present in what's occurring. And that makes each and every moment profoundly meaningful and completely non-distracting. It's the mind of an awakened human being. On hearing sound with the ear, one considers sound as a basis for pleasure, or sound as a basis for disappointment, or sound as a basis for equanimity. I'm going to skip over the other senses. The Buddha says the same thing on those. This last one, referring to the intellect. On cognizing an idea with the intellect, one considers the idea as a basis for pleasure, or the idea as a basis for disappointment, or the idea as a basis for equanimity. That last line points to the whole point of recognizing and abandoning wrong views and wrong thinking. And it also points to the self-identification that we do with our thoughts. Simply because we're having a thought, it's my thought. And because it's my thought, it's got to be the right thought. And that forms a basis for either pleasure or pain. If I hold on to a thought too long and it's proved wrong, whether through direct experience or something else changes my thinking, now I'm disappointed in my thinking. When it was the attachment to the thought, whether it proved satisfying or not, was rooted in wrong view. When I no longer attach myself to my thoughts are simply a basis for equanimity, for calm. Do you see the difference? This is an important one. Between identifying with my thoughts and simply having my thoughts flow. What do we do in meditation? We simply let thoughts arise and flow. We come back to this and say, I'm breathing. We're training ourselves directly in right meditation, in a proper meditation, in the experience of what it's like to be awakened all the time. Our thoughts no longer distract us. And as the Buddha says in the Vatthakasanthana Sutta, we think what we want to think when we want to think it, whatever is appropriate for the situation. We're no longer distracting ourselves with our own thoughts because they're not rooted in the wrong views. These are the six considerations that are conducive. Oh, wait a minute, I think I missed one. No. These are the six considerations that are conducive to pleasure, six considerations that are conducive to disappointment, and six considerations that are conducive to equanimity. Each one of those considerations occur in each and every moment, don't they? It has to do with what we're holding in mind as how, what our experience is going to conduce to, the potential of each and every moment, to become further ignorant or become awakened. A person has these 18 considerations. Furthermore, a wise Dhamma practitioner has four determinations. The determination for discernment, a wise Dhamma practitioner. In other words, an ordinary person won't have these determinations because they don't know they should. They don't have the framework to understand this is where they should be directing their mind. A wise Dhamma practitioner has, this is a little too comfortable, I think. A wise Dhamma practitioner has four determinations. The determination for discernment, or discernment in this case is understanding within the framework of the Eightfold Path. The determination for truth, for understanding Four Noble Truths. Excuse me. Let me go back to the beginning so I just can get all four of those without a burden. The determination for discernment, the determination for the truth, the determination for relinquishment of views rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths, and the determination for calm. I can tell you that for many, many years as a practicing Buddhist and meditating every day and meditating with rather large groups at times, my determination was never for calm because nobody pointed it out to me. My determination was anything other than that. Sometimes it was establishment in Tulsi to heaven. Sometimes it was to find this dimension of nothingness within myself. I did that for many years. That's a very uncalm place. Always striving for something like that. The determination for calm. A wise Dhamma practitioner develops the determination for calm. And that will then guide our whole Dhamma practice, won't it? Especially our meditation practice. Just like we went through in that series on jhana. A wise Dhamma practitioner has these four Dhamma, these four determinations. I'm going to get through this last segment and then we'll call it for today. And how does one not neglect discernment? Through mindfulness of the six properties. Mindfulness means a dispassionate, impersonal look to see these things clearly. And what is the earth property? The earth property can be internal or external. That relates directly to becoming or non-becoming. If it's an external projection of ourselves, even an imaginary, creating a view of myself in my imagination, even though it's in my mind, is an external projection. Is that clear?
Mm-hmm.
And it's also relating to speculation, supposition, and establishment of a self in a non-physical imaginary realm. The earth property can be internal, external, and that'll be clear in just a moment, I think. The internal earth property is anything within oneself that is hard, solid, and sustained by craving, meaning head, hair, body, nails, teeth, skin, flesh, tendons, bones, marrow, kidneys, heart, liver, membrane, spleen, lungs, intestines, contents of the stomach, feces, and anything else internal within oneself that's hard, solid, and sustained by craving. This is called the internal earth property. Both internal earth property and external earth property are simply earth property. So a mind grasping will think, well, I got to figure out how to put myself in both the internal and external property. The Buddha's not teaching that. He's teaching to that common, to what he understood is that common need to establish myself in a non-becoming, non-physical realm. And he's saying, guess what? No matter what your view is, internal, external, it's all the same. It's all internal. It's all happening right here. It's one property. There's nothing outside of this. When we finish this next week, the Buddha makes this declaration that we see what's occurring in the body as the body alone. What's occurring as life is in that life alone. And that's the point. Let me go just a little further. Internal and external properties are simply one, these are my words, simply one property refers to the confused and magical thinking that would establish itself both internally, both internally as physical form and externally in non-physical imaginary realms. Skip forward a little bit. This is how the earth property should be seen by one with right discernment. This is not me, this is not mine, this is not myself, this is not what I am. When one sees this as it has come to be with right discernment, one becomes disenchanted with the earth. It's such an important word. What is enchanted means that we are mesmerized. We're seeing something from a magical point of view, from something that's not based in reality. We become enchanted with our own view of self. Awakening means we become disenchanted. We're no longer confused and mesmerized by our own views. Disenchanted with the earth property and through lack of sustenance, meaning clinging to wrong views, the earth property fades from the mind. It, of course, it does. It fades from the mind as a point of distraction and ongoing speculation. It doesn't mean that we're no longer in a body. The Buddha proved that upon his awakening, and many other people did. I'm gonna stop there because it's a good place to pick up because we'll go through the rest of the properties in that context. But excuse me again. The point that the Buddha is making about these six properties in reference to them is to see that each and every one of them in just this way. This is not me, this is not mine, this is not myself. To depersonalize what we, up until this point, because of a mind rooted in ignorance of how things truly are, personalize it. And it's through that personalization, through self-identification with that which is inherently not me, mine, or myself, that we create ongoing confusion, deluded thinking, and stress and suffering with our lives. When we recognize that, and this doesn't have to be a long analytical process, although for most of us it will be, but it doesn't need to be. At any moment, we can cut ignorance off at the root and awaken, just like Kandana did when he heard the Four Noble Truths for the first time. It's simply recognizing, this is not me, this is not mine, this is myself. not myself. So when you find yourself reacting to something that's occurring, and you may be able to notice the self-identification through that, simply take a breath and remind yourself, wait a minute, this is not me. This is not mine. This is not myself. I don't have to take this personally because it's not happening to me. It's simply happening. And that's true even if somebody's in your face calling you the biggest whatever in the world. It's only through your own self-identification with that situation that, and again, that's an extreme example. You may not be able to do that. I don't know if I could, but that's the point. There's nothing personal, or nothing should be taken personal. And when we can finally realize that through the Eightfold Path, we maintain a calm and peaceful mind. And that's everything as far as the Buddha's concerned, as far as your teacher's concerned. Mm-hmm. That's this part of the sutta. Mary, can you unmute your mic, or do I need to do it? This Mary, I'm sorry. There's a Mary online. Ah, there you go. Okay. why don't we ask Mary first? Any questions or comments, Mary?
I feel like my questions or comments are similar to the last time, that there's a lot here. I want to study more. I didn't get to read this week, so I definitely want to study more. I almost have a sense that I don't want to speak because I feel I comprehend it right now, and I don't want to lose it.
Yeah, there is. There's so much here.
But it's fascinating. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you, Mary. I'm glad you could join us today. Yeah, that after I gave this whole sutta on Tuesday nights, and I think three heads exploded. I think everybody said there's so much here we need to go. I think Russ said maybe three classes, but I think two classes will do with the right context, but we'll see. I mean, and it's such an important sutta, maybe we'll come back to it more often. This is the first time I've taught it. I've been waiting a while. But, Judy.
I have a question about awakening. So this may be, if you're awakened, it's a self-identification. I don't know, but it's, as you're talking and, I'm thinking about situations that come up where you, opportunities to say, this is not me, this is not mine,
Yeah.
And if you're successful in doing that in a situation, it's that one time. Is there a time, I guess, but then another situation arises, you forget. So my question, I guess, is once one is awakened, can you slip back into unawakenedness?
Wow, what a great question. Thank you. Because we're developing the Eightfold Path, we will have experiences along the path. Most of us, unless you're Kundana and a few others, most of us will have experiences that are akin to what an awakened mind would experience. The difference is that an awakened mind, no longer a fully awakened mind, a mind resting in equanimity, because that mind has abandoned all views rooted in ignorance. There's no longer what would be called fetters. Remains calm, but it's. Along the way, it's important to do just what you said, is to recognize those moments of clarity, of understanding, of calm. And we talk about it here all the time. People would say, well, I was in a situation that normally would be so frustrating to me or stressful, and it no longer is. Or I realize the stress is coming on, and I come back to the breath, and I depersonalize it, and I remain calm. What you're doing in a very real way is deconditioning a mind that's conditioned from ignorance. In other words, you're recognizing in the moment something that's not rooted in ignorance. And it's just as important to recognize that as it is to recognize moments that are rooted in ignorance. That's the only way that we can progress, by the way. All those teachings on jhana talk about that. The wisdom of restraint is just that, practicing this restraint, as the Buddha teaches, at the sixth sense base, from our contact with the world. When we find ourselves getting agitated, or maybe recognizing that, even being able to see a little further ahead in the moment, that this is something that may agitate me or in the past has, let me stay present with my breath. Let me stay within myself. and recognize this is not me, this is not mine. And in that way, we're training our minds to awaken, just that way. And it is through, the Buddha's word was ehipasiko, through direct experience that we awaken. It's not through concepts. It's not through listening to someone tell you what to do. It's not through reading. You could read every scripture over and over, meaning Buddhist teachings, over and over again, and that may help. But it's by having it, by developing and incorporating this Eightfold Path in a direct and visceral way that we awaken, by applying it just like you did. And if I could put you on the spot just a little bit, because of your question, you've experienced those moments when you've incorporated the Dhamma in that moment and you remain calm when otherwise you might not have. Is that true?
Sometimes.
That's a profound achievement, Judy. It is. And again, I always say that I'm not given to hyperbole. Most human beings would never have that understanding. They might have moments of calm where they weren't in the same situation calm. Mm-hmm. But you understand where it's you understand the foundation of it in your own mind and in your own body. That's mm-hmm. significant. You know, and it's important to recognize that. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you.
Jen, good to see you this morning.
Yeah, good to see you. I think I agree with Mary that I don't feel like I wish I had a notebook today to take notes, but I'll go back and listen, take notes. There's a lot here, and there's the words. It's rich. It was a rich teaching, because you know, as I was listening to it, I was, noticing just, release. Just release from whatever it was I was clinging to when I was here. You know, just kind of refocus, helps to refocus your mind. And so, thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, this, I'm going to teach this class in two parts again on Tuesday, so you can listen then, you can watch the video. I would encourage you to do this over the next week or so. You can listen to this talk again, read the article, because there is so much here, and we'll probably come back to it often too. Lorna, good morning.
Good morning, everyone. Good to see everyone. Yes, I'll just follow along and say that it's very rich. It's, and everything is really to the point. It's if you blink out of concentration, you've lost a little bit. It's profoundly to point. And I think the fact that you introduced it through dependent origination was very good, because dependent always focuses your mind onto the problem. And that's what we've to see and be aware of for you to get everything out of the sutta. Yeah. You've to see dependent origination and the mechanics of dependent origination from ignorance, how our minds on the 12 links of dependent origination go into confused thinking. So that was a very good leading to this sutra, I think. I think that's all I can just sort of grab my mind on to sort of say at the moment, but it's a profoundly a lot of stuff there.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah, it is. It's very, very basic, but it's also so profound, isn't it? Mm. Becky, good to see you this morning.
Good to be here, John. well, I can't do anything but just agree with what people have said before. I listened to the Tuesday class. And I'm really glad I did, because I felt like I got more out of this than just reading. I would have if I had just read it. And I'm very happy to hear that you're going to be teaching it again on Tuesday, because there's so much in here. And I find that it helps to intellectually understand what the Buddha was teaching, or is teaching, or means by certain things. But I also find that it is the experience that really makes you understand it. I mean, if you haven't had some experience with what Judy said of just having it happen one time or two times, and you know, I don't know how long I've been here now, but maybe it's, I've experienced that calm and equanimity in my mind at a time when without the practice I would have been very upset and distracted. If you've experienced that, then you can take that and you can use that experience to understand what the Buddha is saying. Yeah. But you need both of those.
Yep.
You need both of those, because you can't really feel what the Buddha is saying if you haven't experienced it in some little way.
Yeah.
And it was so just, I don't know what the word is, inspirational, some of the things that were in this sutta.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I just really want to study it some more, because there were some things that you said that just, you know, almost brought me to tears, just because of the way he said it, mm-hmm. and then my knowing through experience what that meant, even if I don't get it right most of the time, you know.
Yeah, you have the framework.
It doesn't matter
understanding it.
If you don't get it right most of the time.
It doesn't.
It's just really, really nice.
Yeah, it's such a profound sutta, and that's how, you know, we're human beings. We first learn things intellectually. We read about it or hear somebody, we don't just then take it on faith. Okay, this is, you know, I'll do this and that. I'll follow
this. You have to have that. Yeah.
You have to experience it. That's what the Buddha in the teaching to the Kalamas. They wanted to know. We have all these different teachers. How do we know who's the right one? And he said the only way you can know is by direct experience. Do this. And he said, if you have any questions
come and see
about
for
it
for yourself.
Yeah. Ask me. Ask me the question. Thank you, Becky.
Thank you,
David. Good to see you this morning.
Hi, John. The Buddha taught two things. He taught the origination of suffering and the cessation of suffering.
Nothing more.
And I know that this and many other suttas are very involved in, you know, you really have to dig in and intellectually understand it. But really, that's the simplicity of what he's saying.
Yeah. It is.
And it's a refinement, and it's for the people who don't awaken immediately, and maybe Ananda had to wait till, you know, after the Buddha passed, but it's all a refinement of the same teaching.
It is.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And it keeps you engaged in it.
Yeah. Thank you. The biggest difficulty, I think, that most of us have with a sutta like this, I mean, it is long and it's involved, but it's also very pure. It's very austere. There's nothing for a mind looking for distraction to be distracted by. And that's difficult for many people. I mean, I you know, from my seat, I see that often. And there's no substitute here. The Buddha's not saying, you know, if this doesn't work, you can you can chant yourself to heaven, to Buddha's heaven, or you can do a bunch of vows, and that's a good substitute. He doesn't give us that break because of the austerity and the clear direction that this is what you do, but it's also, he's saying, it's what you must do if you want to awaken. He didn't say we have to do it, but if you want to awaken within his framework, this is what you have to do.
The interruption of the ignorance.
Yes, and that's the biggest difficulty that people have, and it's why we adapt it and accommodate it and embellish it, because we don't want to face the fact. That's why I say often, you heard me say, that what I've learned, one of the most profound things I've learned from having this seat, is the very powerful but subtle strategies we all create to ignore that basic ignorance, including what we might call Buddhist practice or spiritual practice. It all does the same thing. It's a distracted palliative rather than a direct experience of awakening. Thank you, David. Lisa, good to see you this morning.
Good to see you.
See you, Judy.
Bye. Thank you so
much. Glad you could join us. See you soon.
See you Monday.
Ah, you're seeing Judy on Monday? She's great, isn't she?
She's wonderful, yeah.
Good to see you, Lisa.
It's great to be here to hear you explain that, and it's, yes, my head was going to explode. Even though the basis of it is very direct and simple, it's still this whole world of trying to get there.
Mm-hmm.
So that seems very complex, or maybe my mind just makes it that way. I'm not really sure, but everything you said, so many things that I thought, and each, so many things were like, that could have been a whole discussion in itself.
Yeah.
That I think people would contribute to. And then I like hearing what everyone has to say. When I was reading it, and I'm not sure I read everything, but it seemed, and even from what you said, it seemed a lot of it was on the negative side, that we're trying to avoid unpleasantness.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking about the positive side, I mean, wrong view, but where, and I think early on, I think I came up and said something to you, and it was definitely wrong speech, but
yeah.
About the idea of coincidences, and I think a lot of people depend on or are very comforted by things that happen by coincidence or serendipity or something, that it just things came together and happened that way. Because I said that Jay decided he was going to come to your day-long 12-step program,
mm-hmm.
not knowing you, anything, just nothing. We just see his little ad. And he came back, and it just—well, he just raved about you, you know, about what an interesting person, and you know.
Well, it's not coincidence. It's just
brains and personnel.
No, I'm making a mess.
Okay, that's not the coincidence.
I'm sorry.
But you might remember. I don't know if you remember. I said this, but and then I was then. Further, you know, in this creating community, these little pamp, you know, these little magazines, I said, "Oh, look, he has these." I didn't know what a sangha was. Actually, I might have known the word because our daughter, you know, goes to it. But I said that could be interesting. And then I don't know how long it took us to get around to it or come, but when we came. You said, "Oh, and I'm about to start my annual introduction to Buddhism."
Yeah.
So my point is that, you know, people use the expression "meant to be" all the time, and I think it's comforting to them, in the same way that their religious beliefs are very can be very comforting as well. That you're part of this whole. You know, that was another part of what you were talking about too, about this feeling of belonging, part of a whole, and when things like that happen, you just feel like you're so connected. Okay, it's just that's all wrong, right?
let me be clear about that. No, it's not wrong in a moral sense. It's wrong in relation to the Buddha's Dhamma and his teachings on right view and wrong view, or unskillful and skillful view. That's all. So again, it's not a condemnation on people to take comfort in religion or beliefs, but within the framework of the Eightfold Path, we need to recognize that there's an aspect of eye-making in that.
Yes, and that's exactly how you responded when I said that to you, because...
Oh, good, I'm consistent.
Which is no coincidence.
No coincidence.
Isn't that nice to know?
Good shot.
It's like the world doesn't revolve around me.
Yeah, nor the Dhamma.
Nobody's paying attention. No, as Jay's always saying about, like, he doesn't think that there's some God, and if you pray that your soccer team, you know, or football, you know, they get in the huddle and they have a prayer. Is, you know, does God care about that?
If there is one, I hope not.
You know how I'm trying to relate.
Yeah.
It's all related. We just are who we are. We're trying to be. Okay, I'm not sure what I'm saying, but the one other quick thing, I hope it's going to be quick, is that about you use the word perverted, and sometimes I see our culture, that something, I don't know if something ever happened, because I don't think people have ever changed since we've been Homo sapiens.
Not a lot.
I think we're exactly the same, and as my father would say, that there's the thinnest veneer of civilized behavior on top of, maybe you could just...
I would say that's true.
This on top of brutality, anger out of control. I mean, the things that we see, the things that we're seeing now, and maybe we've always seen, people are exactly the same. And the Buddha's teachings are an example of that.
Yeah, because the problem is the same. The underlying cause of all that is the same.
3,000 years, whatever, you know, whatever it is, whatever writings that, you know, have been passed down, people exactly the same. And I think there's an inclination to perversion, but not, you know, not in, you said, not in that sense.
Yeah, not
know,
in a sexual sense, it's just the perversion
sense,
is...
No, just
not true.
Wrong, I mean, truly wrong thought.
Yeah.
Our culture, our aspirations, are making ourselves important. And the other thing that I thought of was when people are at the top, like they're the valedictorian of their class or whatever, and the one who's the salutary, whatever they call the next one, the salutary, you know what, they are so most of them are so disappointed, because once you're up at the top, you have to fight to stay there. And there's other people that want to be there and knock you down. I don't know, it's so screwed up.
Well, it is, and it's all rooted in what the Buddha awakened to. The Buddha set out trying to understand, why do people suffer the way they do? And he figured it out. It's because we're ignorant of the way things are, and we connect ourselves to things that we shouldn't connect ourselves to. And so he taught a very simple and direct way of recognizing that. And one of the ways of doing that is simply recognizing, no matter what our position is, no matter what we identify ourselves with, I look at the ordinariness of who and what makes us up. earth, wind, fire, water, space, and consciousness. That's it. And everybody has it. No matter how tall or short or skinny or fat or color of skin, anything. It doesn't matter. Except that we make it matter, don't we? Through personalizing it, through self-identification. So he taught this very broad and sometimes seemingly complicated way of looking at the world that is actually very basic and simple and direct. The problem is we have to do it and do it, watch the word, religiously. Thank you, Lisa. Jay, good to see you.
Thanks, nice to be seen. We've been all over the map today, and as usual, listening to what you had to say and what everybody else had to say, I don't know where to start in a comment, except that let's go back to your allegory there about the best baker and wanting to be the best baker. That's trivial. So let's say wanting to be or being a very skilled surgeon. You're putting some meat in the game. You're putting your emotional state. You're responding. Somebody comes in an emergency and you got to get it. You know, you got to snap to it. And you've got some meat in the game there. So the surgeon may have gone to a class on Buddhism and may be calm at home and calm in most circumstances, but anybody is going to wind up with times when calm is the wrong thing. You know, getting excited or responding quickly is important. But you got to decide: do you want to be that surgeon, or do you just want to be an academic or a anchorite is what they used to call them, the guy sitting in the cave, you know, at perfect peace. You have choices in this life, and I've said it many times, I choose to stay on the bad side of things in some cases, even though I may know a better way, and hopefully on the day that calm is the solution, I will be calm. One time I had a guy out of the Union Hall running my 40-ton crane, he turned it over. And people, I was up in North Jersey running another crane. The guy called me, the foreman, he said, we turned your crane over. I said, you're kidding. And he said, no, we turned it over. You know, they did, doing something stupid. Nobody was hurt. It was about 100-degree day. And somehow I found the calm to, instead of just flipping out over the whole thing, I told the foreman on the job I was on what happened. And I packed up the crane. I drove 60 miles down to where the other guy was. And, people thought I was going to flip out for some reason or whatever, but there was nothing to do about it. It had been done. Nobody was hurt. So I fairly calmly arranged and got some extra help to upright the thing. And people that day and people later on when I was talking to the contractor about the legalities of what had happened and whose insurance was going to cover things, said they can't believe that I was so calm about it. But it wouldn't have done any good for me to jump up and down and freak out, you know? Mm-hmm. And I was calm in a very peculiar way because there was a lot of stuff happening that day. And Lisa wound up having to come down and pick me up by 7, 8 o'clock at night by the time we finally got the crane packed up, and she followed me back to our yard. But that was an occasion where I think people thought that I was going to completely lose my mind. It wouldn't have helped anything the slightest bit to have gone all nuts about it. That's all.
Thank
really
you. Yeah, sometimes an extreme event, it's easier to remain somewhat focused than it is ordinary things that keep coming up and up, coming up again. But you're talking about the surgeon. I would much prefer to have a surgeon well trained in the Buddha's Dhamma, who is very efficient and calm no matter how busy they get with a surgery. You see what I'm saying? Somebody that is able to maintain that calm. A calm mind doesn't mean a stagnant mind. It simply means you're not well-focused, and you're probably going to be much more efficient and make much less mistakes as a surgeon with a calm mind than one who loses it or gets too excited.
Clarity,
yeah. I mean, that's true about, again, it's a good, taking that from someone who has a skin in the game rather than the baker. But even the baker has skin in the game. From
his point of view.
From refined mindfulness, whether I'm a baker or a surgeon or a cab driver, refined mindfulness tells me to be present with what I'm doing. It doesn't, there's no because it might seem there's more skin in the game for me being a surgeon, that doesn't affect my level of mindfulness. And it certainly won't affect my experience of my life, whether I'm a cab driver or a surgeon, if I can be mindfully present. In other words, each moment driving that cab is as meaningful as it is for that brain surgeon, or whatever kind of surgeon it might be, simply because you're there and that's what you find yourself in. You brought up a good point. Thank you, Jay. Mary, good to see you. It's good to have you back.
Good to be here. I mean, this was really a heavy talk to come in on, but, back on, but I mean, there's so much to it, and it resonates and makes a lot of sense. I need to listen to it again, but I mean, he was just, to me, he was ahead of his time. Although what he teaches is really timeless.
Yeah.
Be ahead of his time. They have recognized a part of the brain where they think, they call it the default mode network, which is basically the ego sits. And when in the brains of meditators and in the brains of people who take magic mushrooms, they see changes in that area of the brain, and which I find fascinating.
Yeah.
People who have taken the magic mushrooms describe it as coming out of it devoid of their ego, basically, which is, you know, one of the goals of meditation, and it's the whole subject is just fascinating from start to finish, and makes me want to really understand more and more of how the Buddha got to the conclusions he got to. I mean, he was just amazing.
Oh yeah, and that I always felt that was the case, even though this I was meditating before science was even looking at it, that it really was just that we could change our composition and function of our brain by how and what we think and being well concentrated. And so, yeah, they're starting to prove it now. The you brought me back to my Hawaiian days and magic mushrooms. And they do tend to diffuse your ego, but in a way that establishes you in a non-becoming state. Honestly, I'm not being silly about it. I don't know that that's a real substitute for meditation. They might prove it otherwise, but my experience of it was more of escaping my ego rather than understanding what I had done to create confusion, delusion, and suffering in my life.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah.
And honestly, they both might be valuable.
Well,
in a societal sense.
Same part of the brain.
Pardon me?
They both affect the same part of the brain.
Yeah.
And the mushrooms. Yeah.
Yeah,
from
my experience, I would rather have this now. I mean, I know right. I could get on a plane right now, and I know right where to go. There's a whole field. I do. It's still,
yeah.
It's always there. It's right near Green Lake. The volcano is running right there. But hopefully, but anyway, the point is that even if they proved that it's true that you could take this mushroom or do this practice and achieve the same thing, I think I'd rather do this practice, but who knows?
Well, I think doing the practice also, because you're doing it all the time, it lasts longer, because they describe the effects of the mushrooms as wearing off over time. And I think in the book I'm reading, people always had a guide on their trips,
yep.
Which I think makes a difference too with the mushrooms.
Yep.
But with, like I said, with the meditation, it's something you can sit down and do yourself every day,
mm-hmm.
and it's just going to reinforce. Yeah.
Yeah.
But
that's
also,
right.
If you're only meditating, or only doing mushrooms, you're not doing the Eightfold Path.
Yeah,
it's
not
in a broader framework,
yeah.
And then you're so really it's
temper.
You guys are it's both right. You gotta constantly work, and if so, yeah.
Yeah, you can't just meditate.
Yeah, I know.
Doing
I think
right.
We're talking
that's
about
what,
people who were in a meditation practice along with, because they also were recognizing a Buddhist meditation practice.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So people who learned how to meditate and learned. I mean, it's just
amazing. Well, even, yeah, most of those people in those studies aren't, I would bet, I don't know for sure, but just because knowing the way things are, I would bet they're actually developing the Eightfold Path.
Yeah.
But it does show that any well-focused meditation practice will have a profound effect on your brain. And that's a good thing. And if you want to develop awakening and maintain that, establish it, it's through an Eightfold Path. But we might all just do some mescaline next week.
Yeah.
Yeah. Are you reading the
mushrooms, John?
No, I'm reading How to Change Your Mind, which
I was wondering what this.
Which,
I was going
which
to ask you
goes through the whole history of it.
How to change your
and
mind.
I would,
that's
if I could find a guide, I would do the Magic Mushrooms in the New York Minute.
Yeah.
Just to experience it.
Yeah.
It
no, I understand.
Like it's just really, really fascinating.
And the author?
Michael Pollan.
Ah.
Yes, it's called How to Change Your Mind.
Michael Pollan.
Yeah.
He, all right.
Yeah,
the
he's
one
a,
he
I was just kidding, folks. I don't
guy.
Want us
yeah.
to be doing mushrooms here.
Because the whole, it's a fascinating read. I'm taking my time reading it because it really is a fascinating read.
Oh. Am I correct that you are a therapist?
No.
Oh, I thought
no.
you were. Because
no.
I know there are some people in the class.
I'm just another crazy person.
Oh, just another crazy person. I was just saying, I'm pretty sure that you could go online if you really wanted and find a local therapist who would supervise that use because
I've
they're having
to my therapist about it and he hasn't he doesn't have any thinking that maybe he had a connection but he doesn't know.
I'm sure you could find one because they're having a lot of luck with that with soldiers from overseas
correct.
Who are having
they're doing
post-traumatic
they're actually doing
stress
the proper studies with them now.
Yeah, well they find that they can get to the heart of what they want to say eat more easily under the influence of psilocybin in particular I guess
and also LSD
and LSD
yeah.
which that and MSDA, whatever the hell that is.
MDMA.
MDMA, which was abused and, you know, completely the thing people would take it and go to a discotheque and have a wonderful
yeah.
time. But they find that if it's given in the proper dosage and the correct chemical, which when things are bought on the street,
you don't know
what the hell they really are.
Yeah.
And so these kids are taking pills that may or not be that. You know? But
yeah.
if you could get to a source where you were taking the very thing, apparently it lets people get to the heart of the matter where it would take years in therapy to get them to get to that.
But they can get to it also with the meditation, with the proper guidance. I mean, it takes longer. It's just, if people
maybe.
Only knew, this room would be too small.
Yeah. Well, I always say, thank you, Mary. I mean, the other problem with all of that is as chemicals affect each and everybody differently.
Different.
And so
right.
there might be a small group or maybe a large group of people that could take certain mushrooms and be guided through it and achieve some level of ego reduction. And you're going to find a large number of people that will do the same thing and literally lose their minds and never come back. I know those people. I've had friends like that. So there's some dangers involved in all of that. I've talked about here, there's dangers in a meditation practice that is not well focused within the framework of the Eightfold Path. You can become increasingly anxious and get to the point of psychosis if you're just meditating and not understanding what's going on. You know, that happens too. So anyway, thank what was the name of the book?
How to Change Your Mind.
Great. Michael Pollan. Thank you.
Well, did you read A Very Good Day about the woman that took LSD?
No.
Tiny. You would be fascinated.
All right.
A Very Good Day.
You'll have to get some paper out here and exchange titles.
Reading list.
No,
yeah,
really.
Absolutely
it's very interesting. I read that as well.
Andrew, good to see you. How are you? Excuse me.
For me, the key word from this teaching is the word calm, which is a goal as I picked up. Meditation and equanimity is just a state that can be applied to everyday life.
Yeah.
And I try to pick out the simplest concepts with each of these teachings.
That's a good
because there's so much there usually.
Yeah.
But that was it today.
That is the point. Thank you, Andrew. And it is best to look at it's best to look at these in the simplest way possible because they are simple and basic. There's just a lot to consider too. So we'll have part two on next Saturday, and we're going to do this on Tuesdays again. Part one and two this Tuesday and next Tuesday. The talk's online. The videos are online. So I would ask you to maybe take some time this week to review this, and it really is such a profound teaching. Mary, are you? Yeah, you're still with us. You have anything to add? No. Okay. All right. We'll. I can't.
Hi, everyone.
Hello.
I couldn't get off mute.
Okay. Thank you for joining us, Mary. We'll do text part two next Saturday. We'll finish with metta as we always do. So again, find your relaxed meditation posture. gently close your eyes, gently close your mouth, and take a moment to become mindful of your in-breath and your out-breath. And these are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties, and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing and gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class this morning. Peace.
Thank you.
Thank you, John.
Thank you, John.
Thank you all. Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.